with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more. This is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
You've heard the COVID mantras over and over. Wear a mask, social distance, stay at home. This week, we'll talk to an expert from the Cleveland Clinic for some practical advice you've probably never heard, advice that goes well beyond the general instructions. Then, eating disorders are already complex medical issues, but how has COVID-19 created additional challenges? We'll get the answer from a Mayo Clinic psychologist. And even before the pandemic, America was struggling with an epidemic of anxiety issues, including PTSD. We'll learn techniques that may help those suffering from mental trauma. That's all straight ahead on Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
We've heard it over and over. Wear a mask, keep social distance, disinfect surfaces. We probably feel we could recite the COVID-19 safety instructions in our sleep. But now, Cleveland Clinic has issued a set of recommendations that go well beyond the general instructions, with important explanations that you don't hear often, if at all. Good advice. It's the Clorox and Cleveland Clinic Safer at Home, your guide to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining me now to share this is Dr. James Merlino at Cleveland Clinic. Doctor, some of the resistance to mask wearing stems from several myths, which your guide debunks. Let's take those one at a time. I noticed a recent study reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association saying 59% of all COVID transmission comes from people with no symptoms. Now, doesn't this disprove the myth that people can assume they're fine and therefore don't need to wear a mask if they feel fine?
It does disprove the myth, because what happens is that people can be shedding the virus and not know it. They can be perfectly healthy and they can be infectious to others. And that's why it's really important that we wear a mask all the time when we're out or we're with other people. Because if we're shedding the virus, the mask can help protect others. And there's also the possibility that wearing a mask will protect you from others who could be shedding. So it is definitely a myth. Mask use is very important. It will protect you.
And another myth is simply that wearing a cloth mask is useless. What's the truth on that?
The truth is that any mask is better than no mask. Cloth masks are effective. Certainly surgical masks are better. But if you're wearing a cloth mask, that will help protect others from you. And actually, the data shows today that it can protect you as well. So that is clearly a myth. Wearing a mask, it can be cloth. It is the right thing to do, and it can help you.
So here's another myth. A mask will make me sick because I'm breathing the gases I exhale instead of fresh air. Any truth to that one?
Well, that's kind of an interesting myth, and it's absolutely false. Because keep in mind the logic there, right? If you already have the air inside of you and you're breathing it into the mask, it's not going to make you more sicker. You're probably already sick. So, no, breathing air through a mask is not going to make you sick.
What about if I'm wearing a mask, I don't need to social distance, or even the reverse of that, doctor? That if I'm social distancing, I don't need to wear a mask. Do these go together, actually?
They go together, because while wearing a mask is the most important thing that you can do to protect yourself and others, social distancing is the next most important thing. The way you should think about these is like layers of Swiss cheese. There's holes in every piece of cheese. No cheese is perfect. But if you line up enough things together, enough slices of Swiss cheese together, you create a better barrier. So wearing a mask is an element of that Swiss cheese, right? It's going to protect you. Social distancing is another one. It's going to give you added protection. Now, the interesting thing about masks is that that can protect you when you're in situations where you can't necessarily completely socially distance. But you should apply both whenever you can, but always wear the mask.
We're visiting with Dr. James Merlino of Cleveland Clinic regarding a guide they've recently issued on staying safe during the pandemic. Doctor, not all hand sanitizers are created equal, as you know. Now, the guide recommends we use hand sanitizers with a certain percentage of alcohol. What percentage do you feel we should look for on the label?
Well, there's a lot of talk about what makes an appropriate hand sanitizer relative to its alcohol content. I think generally speaking, people believe about 60% alcohol content is what you should shoot for. The reality is that the COVID virus is very fragile. And so there's no confirmed case where somebody touches something with it infected and then transmits it to themselves, an inanimate object. We believe it's possible, which is why we advocate that people should keep surfaces disinfected and our hands clean. But it's the fact that it's a very fragile virus that helps us have a margin of error around hand washing. So if you get hand sanitizer that's at 60%, if you wash your hands with soap and water, you're going to be just fine.
And if we have a choice between washing our hands with soap and water or using a hand sanitizer, which is preferred?
I think that a lot of people would argue that washing your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water is better than hand sanitizer. And I think there's probably groups that would say that they're equivalent if you use hand sanitizer in an effective fashion. Personally, I tend to use hand sanitizer more than I wash my hands. I think it's much more efficient. But I think they will both protect you if you do them appropriately and you're using the proper hand sanitizer.
And what is your advice about wearing gloves? Can gloves protect us?
No, because keep in mind that wearing gloves is not any different than sanitizing your hands frequently. And we shouldn't be thinking that if we wear gloves, we don't have to sanitize our hands, because all you're doing is substituting a bad practice for not being vigilant about keeping your hands clean. Now, if you are a food service worker or you're a maintenance worker who does cleaning, of course you should wear gloves to protect yourself and also protect food if you're handling it. But in everyday use, there's no benefit to wearing gloves to protect yourself from getting the virus. The bottom line is wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, keep your hands clean, don't touch your face. That's what's going to protect you.
And isn't a piece of the puzzle that if your gloves get contact with the coronavirus, that can transmit to your body too, just like your skin if you touch your eyes or your some other substance that has a way into the body?
Well, that's the point, right? So if you wear gloves instead of frequently using hand sanitizer or washing your hands and not touching your face, you're not alleviating the risk. You'd have to wear gloves and wash your gloves, right? Or use hand sanitizer on your gloves to really get the same effect. So the bottom line is you're just creating an extra step and a false sense of security and potentially putting yourself at risk because you're likely not washing your hands or using hand sanitizer if you're wearing gloves because you think you don't have to. So don't wear the gloves.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about these important safety guidelines. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. James Merlino of the Cleveland Clinic regarding important advice that drills down on avoiding COVID in the Clorox and Cleveland Clinic publication they've released entitled Safer at Home, Your Guide to the Coronavirus Pandemic. Doctor, we were talking before about cleaning surfaces. Now, in many parts of the country, regular disinfectants are just not available. How can people make their own?
Well, certainly when you think about what we're trying to do here, which is deactivate the virus, destroy the virus, which I said earlier is very fragile. It has what's called a lipid membrane around it, so it's very sensitive to heat. It's very sensitive to soap and detergents. A lot of things can help you make a disinfectant at home, like adding ammonia to water would be a good disinfectant. Adding bleach to water would be a good disinfectant. And then, you know, wiping down surfaces, adding soap to water and wiping down surfaces. I think all of that would be effective at likely taking care of eliminating the risk from the COVID virus.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned multiple things, because I was going to ask that many people want to get the best cleaner. They may be tempted to mix chemicals in their homemade disinfectant. Is that a bad idea?
Well, we have to be thoughtful here, right? We don't want to create a bigger risk than what we're trying to fight on the COVID virus when we're disinfecting surfaces. So I have heard anecdotes of people using things like gasoline or kerosene. Those are very dangerous and not acceptable. Once again, we have to be reasonable. Think about the types of materials in everyday disinfectants. And those materials are things like basic soap, things like ammonia, things like bleach. So if you take those chemicals and you add them to water and dilute a mixture and then use that to disinfect, you're going to be safe and you're going to accomplish what you want to do. But let's just make sure that we're using common sense before we start mixing dangerous chemicals together to create something that we think is going to destroy the COVID virus on our tables.
And on the subject of bleach, I believe your guide recommends 5 tablespoons of bleach per gallon of room temperature water. Now, if you go with that mixture and you apply it to a surface, and you have to be careful that it won't fade with the bleach, how long would we want to let it sit on the surface before we wipe it off?
I don't think you need to let it sit on the surface for a long time. I think simply wiping it off is wiping the surface off is going to be adequate disinfectant.
Okay, let's switch over to social distancing now. Does the latest information indicate that much of the COVID spread actually occurs in the home?
What we know about the surge that's occurring is that it's likely coming from small groups of people gathering together. And when we think about where that occurs, right, it occurs at bars, it occurs at social events, it occurs at anywhere people get together. And so certainly being at home is an example. So, you know, we are very social people. We want to be with others. We want to be with our families and friends, particularly around the holidays. And so there's a tendency to lose our mindfulness around what's important. So when we gather together with groups in our homes, with people that are not normally in our, quote, bubble, people that we know are careful, that we're always around, that are not socializing with others, when we break that kind of contract we have with our families or our small groups and we introduce others, we put ourselves and others at risk. So I wouldn't say that at home is the only place people are getting COVID, but it is a place that people are getting COVID, particularly when they gather with people they're not normally with. Now, just as a one way to think about this is that businesses and hospitals in particular have gotten very good at protecting people from getting COVID. And then what happens is they go home and they're not as careful, or they're not thinking about it. They're losing their mindfulness about what they should do. And COVID comes in through what we describe as the back door. So we cannot lose track of the fact that we're still living with COVID. We're going to be living with it for a while. We have to be vigilant.
And part of this, I would think, involves habits that are hard to break, like family members sharing food in the home. Is that an example of something that's a danger for transmission?
I think the bigger risk of transmission is when family members start to socialize with people and they're not careful. You know, if you're living with your wife or your husband and your kids, and you're sharing meals at the dinner table, and you're being careful relative to who you're spending time with, where you're going, and you're also being mindful of using precautions like masks and social distancing, you know, sharing food is not going to hurt you. There's not a lot of evidence that COVID is transmitted through food. It is really all about being mindful and protecting yourself and, you know, staying out of big groups, wearing your mask, and social distancing.
Our guest today is Cleveland Clinic's Dr. James Merlino with the latest on pandemic safety. Doctor, as you know, the pandemic has created a lot of loneliness as people isolate. How concerned are you, a physician, about the general public's health due to loneliness and possible long-term effects on our psyche?
I don't think we're going to know the effects of COVID on our psychological safety as a society until we've conquered this disease. You know, we are seeing increasing episodes of depression, increasing mental illness, increasing addiction, increasing social violence, domestic violence, all during this time of the pandemic, all likely because of the pandemic. And the scale of that, I think right now, is just incalculable. But it is a very real issue. And we have to be thoughtful about it. And we have to recognize that as a society, as a medical community, it is something that we are going to have to deal with.
And what are some of the signs that we should look for to see if a family member or a friend is developing depression?
Well, I think that, you know, social isolation is one, and that's a cause and a symptom. You know, we're socially isolating because of the pandemic, and, you know, certainly as people become mildly depressed or moderately depressed, they start to withdraw. So, you know, it's an important sign, but it's something to pay attention to. Irritability, inability to sleep, not eating, increased use of alcohol or drugs are all examples of signs that someone could be depressed or going from mild depression to worse depression.
And how important would exercise be in counteracting depression or just stress?
Well, I think in general, exercise is important for our health. And so we should be thinking about how we do regular exercise. Certainly, exercise can reduce stress, can help reduce depression. So exercise is a good thing, pandemic or not. We should be doing as much as we can.
All terrific advice. And for those interested in getting a copy of this guide, search in your browser for COVID-19: Creating a Safer Workplace. That's COVID-19: Creating a Safer Workplace. Scroll down to the words for keeping safer at home. Dr. James Merlino of Cleveland Clinic, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my absolute pleasure to participate, and I hope that this information is helpful to people as we continue to battle this terrible pandemic to keep ourselves, our families, and our friends safe.
Thank you. MedClinic Radio will be back in a moment with a look at the struggle against eating disorders in the age of COVID-19. Stay with us.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed.
We have an epidemic in this country of obesity and sedentary lifestyle.
Dr. Edward Laskowski says anything to get people moving can be helpful. In recent years, high-intensity functional training programs have grown in popularity. However, exercises that may involve jumping or ballistic movements or are complex to perform come with a higher risk of injury.
These classes are usually very motivating. They're very social, and they involve very simple things, oftentimes just your body weight to get your heart rate up and receive benefit.
So what's the best way to avoid getting hurt?
With strength training, technique is key. We say it's not practice that makes perfect, it's perfect practice. For example, if you do a squat improperly, the back could be at risk.
It's also important to monitor fatigue. When someone is tired, their form tends to deteriorate, making them more susceptible to injury. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Eating disorders are complex medical issues, and the COVID-19 pandemic has created additional challenges for people who battle these disorders. With this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
For people suffering from eating disorders, COVID-19 has brought new challenges to them. For some, there is constant access to food while they are home, socially isolating. For others, they lack the social support that they have had previously. And stress and anxiety are also contributing to increased risk from eating disorders during COVID-19. Further, there's the concern that being overweight will cause worsening of COVID-19 or a worse outcomes for some patients. So this is a very challenging time for many. Well, I am gratified to have with us today to discuss this Dr. Leslie Sim, a psychologist at Mayo Clinic who specializes in this area. I think one of the first things that you could clarify for listeners and for me are, what exactly are eating disorders? When I was in high school and people talked about eating disorders, I sort of thought of those, or we kind of talked about those like it was maybe anorexia and maybe bulimia. But I imagine there's a broader definition of that.
Absolutely. So eating disorders represent a broad range of different conditions. They're serious mental health conditions. They're very complex. They really involve a preoccupation with food, weight, shape that result in some pretty dangerous eating behaviors that have life-threatening consequences many times.
So have you, and in our practice and nationally, has there been an increase in the incidence of eating disorders that are recognized during COVID-19?
A great question. We are seeing an influx of patients with serious eating disorders or worsening of symptoms. Patients who may have previously been doing pretty well and were fairly stable are now experiencing a worsening of symptoms. We can hardly keep up with the demand.
What factors do you think play a role in that influx that you're seeing?
It's kind of the perfect storm. The same things that seem to worsen mental health conditions in general are really affecting eating disorders. So we're thinking about things like social isolation. We're seeing people having a lot more uncertainty in their life. They're not out in the world, so they're not distracted from their stress and anxiety. They're finding a lot more alone time to ruminate on their distress. There's the economic pressures. They don't have purpose and meaning in their life right now, as they're not out doing what they need to be doing. They're saying, you know, is it even worth it for me to recover? What's in my future? There's a number of different problems that they're experiencing.
You know, I had read an interesting article a couple of months ago, but well into COVID-19, where the time of the Great Depression and some other major times of crises in the United States were being compared to COVID-19 and how those stressors actually pushed people more to having concerns about mood disorders, anxiety, and disordered use of substances, probably even including food in this situation. And I found that really fascinating. Have you seen those parallels?
Oh, absolutely. There's just a number of parallels, as well as some modern day problems. So we're seeing people having fewer access to food with these food shortages and hoarding. We're also having the opposite problem where parents might be hoarding food in the garage and then having their young person having much more access. Sleep schedules are really disrupted, and that might allow kids to miss out on meals or to wake up in the middle of the night to binge eat. Gyms are closed, so they're having more difficulties with physical activity in kind of more of a healthy way. So a lot of challenges.
Leslie, I was just speaking with one of your colleagues specifically about opioid use disorder, but also other substance use disorders. Is the brain chemistry that is involved in those sorts of disorders similar to what is known to be involved in eating disorders, or are they completely disparate topics?
I think there's a lot of overlap. We are learning a lot more about the neurobiology of eating disorders, and we're finding that there is some overlap, and there's also some really distinct biological pathways that are involved in eating disorders.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about treatment options and how you're being a bit overwhelmed in your arena trying to offer treatment. What is the range of treatments that might be offered to someone who has an eating disorder?
In a non-COVID time, we would do for children and adolescents with eating disorders, kind of a face-to-face, family-based treatment, which really involves parents helping to refeed their child, knowing that a lot of the symptoms of eating disorders are actually symptoms of starvation. And so you need to refeed the young person in order to help the brain function more normally before any kind of psychotherapy would be thought to be effective. So parents are really charged with refeeding the child and supported to do that by the therapist kind of face-to-face. And that's an outpatient, once a week kind of a treatment. Under the challenges of COVID, we are attempting to do this via telehealth, and we're experiencing some success in this and also some challenges in this treatment.
What are the challenges associated with telehealth?
Well, a big thing with eating disorders is we need to do a lot of physical monitoring. We have to understand whether the person is meeting expectations for increase in weight, knowing that that's a big outcome that we're looking for is improvement in weight and kind of physical status, physical health. We also need to monitor their physical health, taking their blood pressure, heart rate, and that becomes a big challenge in the home setting. We're having family members try to attempt to do the weights, but children can potentially, if they're struggling with an eating disorder, they might attempt to manipulate the weight by, you know, wearing lots of undergarments and other kinds of things, or just refuse to do a weight, or the distress in seeing their weight in a not of a structured setting can be a challenge. I've worked with a young child who was absolutely refusing to eat, and I was concerned about her physical health and wanted her to go in to see her primary care provider. And her mom was very worried about going in to the doctor related to her daughter catching COVID. And I had to try to explain that the risks of starvation and dehydration were much greater than the risk of going to see her medical provider and becoming infected with COVID.
I think that's true of other disease states. We've talked about cancer and need to surveil and cardiac disease. And so I think patients have this fear of going to see their provider during the time of COVID due to concerns about the virus. And so that's a great point that you've made. You've talked quite a bit about children. Are eating disorders more common in certain age ranges?
Adolescence is a peak time of developing an eating disorders, but we're seeing them throughout the lifespan. So it is a concern throughout adulthood and even into late adulthood, we are seeing eating disorders.
Are most patients who have eating disorders underweight or are there overweight patients with eating disorders as well?
Eating disorders affect people of all shapes and sizes. When we think of eating disorders, we often think of anorexia, which might be thought of as being very underweight, but that's actually a very small subset of patients. We're even seeing patients with anorexia in larger bodies. And these people are not being recognized as readily, unfortunately, because the longer an eating disorder goes on, the harder it is to treat.
How would one recognize an eating disorder in someone that they love or someone that they live with or a family member?
Any major shift in one's eating patterns. So not eating with the family, saying they're not hungry, maybe finding food in a child's room, hoarding food, going to the bathroom after meals, any kind of change in weight can be a red flag.
What should be the first step if there's concern about an eating disorder?
I would say calling your primary care provider and seeking treatment immediately, getting an assessment.
You talked a little bit about the risks of untreated eating disorders, and I'm wondering, what are some of the long-term lifetime risks on physical health that you see in patients who have eating disorders?
So eating disorders are one of the most deadly mental health problems, only second behind opioid overdose for the seriousness and life-threatening nature of the condition. Many patients with eating disorders actually die from suicide. But we also know that eating disorders affect every organ system. They have a very broad impact. There was a longitudinal study that studied adolescents with eating disorders and followed them into adulthood and found that they had long-term chronic health conditions.
That's really interesting. I had never been aware before that they were such a significant concern for longevity even or for mortality. But fascinated me, the comparison to opioid use disorder. I was going to ask you if there's a connection between mood disorders and eating disorders, because you mentioned suicide. It makes sense, but I had never understood that risk before.
Yeah, huge overlap. Anxiety disorders are probably a big risk factor for the development of eating disorders. We sometimes will see depression being a consequence of starvation, as well as just feeling like a failure in managing eating and weight. Binge eating really leads to some significant mood disturbance over time. So we see the symptoms of eating disorders contributing to mood disorders, and the symptoms of anxiety tend to precipitate the development of an eating disorder.
That's really interesting. I know that when I was younger, they used to talk about this need to have something that you could control as contributing, and I don't know whether that's truth or a myth, but that sort of anxiety, I would imagine.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of these kids prior to developing an eating disorder have a history of a clinically diagnosed eating disorder. I think it's about 30%. And if they don't have an anxiety disorder, they would have high levels of kind of harm avoidance. And if you think about it, starvation is a way to kind of quell the sympathetic nervous system. It kind of calms people down. It's almost, they describe it as better than Ativan. So you can think about how if you are an anxious person, one way to manage that anxiety is just to not eat so that you can get through and function. Also, you know, it's a nice distraction task. So if I can focus on not eating or what I'm going to have for lunch today, then I don't have to think about all of my stress and anxiety. So it really can become a way to manage high levels of anxiety.
Oh, we're so grateful to you for being here, Dr. Sim. It was lovely to meet you by Zoom today.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Leslie Sim, psychologist at the Mayo Clinic, for discussing eating disorders with us today.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is part of Med Clinic Radio, courtesy of the Mayo Clinic News Network. The Mayo Clinic Q&A podcast is available wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. Up next, anxiety and PTSD have been on the rise for several years, even before the pandemic. We'll talk to a psychotherapist for advice on coping with mental trauma. MedClinic Radio continues in a moment.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
We've heard federal health officials report symptoms of anxiety and depressive disorders increased considerably in the U.S. during the pandemic. But even before this coronavirus, experts sounded the alarm about rising anxiety in this country, noting a substantial jump from 2017 to 18. But there is help. Dr. Lori Nadel, a psychologist specializing in traumatic stress, brings coping tools in an important book, The Five Gifts, Discovering Hope, Healing, and Strength When Disaster Strikes. She joins us now. Doctor, how would you characterize the problem of anxiety in America?
I think we're really looking at a national epidemic of anxiety issues. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a very large category of that. We're actually looking at 200 million Americans will suffer some kind of traumatic stress in the next 5 years, and there is already a pre-existing population of a couple of hundred thousand, so that's substantial.
And it's not just the soldiers that we hear about who may suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. People who've suffered sexual or other physical abuse and other traumas may also have PTSD, yes?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, trauma is something that can happen to anyone, any place, in any stage of life. And when we have PTSD, which is a kind of delayed stress reaction, that's because we're a normal person having normal reactions to what was a sudden and violent event or situation.
Now, your book mentions the five gifts, as you call them, to help people with PTSD heal. Let's drill down and take them individually. First, how does humility help us cope with trauma?
You know, humility is kind of not really something that's very popular in a country that values people by how many followers they have on social media. Humility is really releasing the sense of entitlement that this shouldn't happen to me or this shouldn't have happened to me. And I spoke to people from a lot of different countries where they can handle adversity with a kind of sense of calm, and humility was one of the primary values that they stressed as important.
Gift number two is patience. How do we find patience, though, when some of our basic needs, such as food and shelter, are immediate?
Well, there are survival needs. Patience is really the ability to keep calm and to accept that the frustrations that we're feeling in the moment are very real and that they might go on for longer than we would like. And so when people are still struggling emotionally a year or 2 years after an event, patience is the gift that, again, kind of helps us to let go and just take a deep breath and say, you know, well, this is how I'm feeling, and I guess it's just going to take time to heal.
And empathy, your third gift, how does that play a role in helping us heal?
Well, I think empathy is what we see right after a disaster when the rescue workers and the cleanup crews go in. But the help cycle lasts about 2 months, and so what we really need is sustainable empathy. We need relationships with people who will be accepting and understanding, for the long haul, which is usually 3 to 5 years after an event.
Another gift, forgiveness. Now, you did work with victims of 9/11, and that led to a strong pro-United States sentiment and us versus them sort of idea. How did 9/11 victims forgive hijackers?
Well, I don't know that some of them have, and some of them understand perhaps a little bit about the circumstances, that culture that could have allowed or engaged that kind of philosophy. But when I talk about forgiveness, I really talk about actively being in a forgiving state. So it's not a light switch. And I don't know that anyone who had a direct loss after 9/11, you know, can ever forgive the perpetrators 100%. And that is, I think, completely understandable. But we can be in a forgiving place, and maybe we can be forgiving of ourselves because we couldn't prevent that from happening. Or we may be forgiving 2% or 5% or 30%, and we can still experience what it's like to have that gift of not holding on to anger and not holding on to resentment.
We're visiting with Dr. Lori Nadel, a specialist in traumatic stress, regarding her new book, The Five Gifts, Discovering Hope, Healing, and Strength When Disaster Strikes. Your fifth gift is growth. And is that a separate goal to pursue, or does that sort of result from the first four?
It's my belief that growth is something that happens naturally and organically through and with the first four, or as a result of the first four. It's sometimes called post-traumatic growth. And when you're experiencing the gift of growth, you're able to look back at the event and say, I wish I hadn't had to go through that. I would never wish it on anybody else, but I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't learned those lessons. I would never know how strong I could be if I hadn't gone through that. And so growth is the gift that lets us look at the world through our eyes in the present, looking towards the future, instead of looking at the world through the eyes of somebody whose life has just been shattered. So it's like when a wound heals up, like after a paper cut. Scar tissue is there, but the skin is whole. That's growth.
Doctor, it seems that there are two, shall we say, buckets for trauma. One is what's happening during an attack, and the second, dealing with the aftermath. Now, you have talked about a technique that you have for staving off a panic attack using your breath and thinking of colors. How does this work?
Well, there's a very strong mind-body connection, and the autonomic nervous system responds to images. So, for example, if I were to tell you to take a piece of lemon now and put it in your mouth, would you feel the lemon in your mouth, so to speak?
I suppose.
But there's not actually a physical lemon. So your body, your autonomic nervous system acts as though there is. And in the same way, when you're starting to panic, if you can center into where in your body you're feeling the panic and close your eyes and kind of ask, what color would help my chest to feel better? What color would help my shoulders to relax? Whatever color comes into your mind, you can just breathe it in and kind of feel that it's going to those areas that are stressed. And as you exhale, you can release any stress, any panic, any anxiety by breathing out a different color. And your body, your autonomic nervous system will respond to that.
And you do have another technique, thinking of your mind as a computer cursor. How does that work?
Well, that's really interesting because your mind is really whatever you choose to focus on. So if you're balancing your checkbook, for those of us who are old enough to still have checkbooks, or you're doing some kind of financial task, that cursor is over in the left brain, the part of the brain that thinks in numbers and logic. And, you know, if you're kind of relaxing, your brain may kind of shift over to the right brain, which is images. And the midbrain is where all of our feelings are stored. And if you think about your mind as a cursor, and you let that cursor kind of take everything that's going on in your mind, in your body, in your heart, just like gravity, bring it down to your feet, and you rub your feet on the ground so that that's the only thing that you're aware of. What it does is it completely empties out kind of the storehouse, whatever's going on in your mind, whether it's racing thoughts, whether it's fear, whether it's anxiety, whether it's depression, because your feet can only do feet things. So your feet cannot have a panic attack. And that will save you within a matter of seconds.
Dr. Lori Nadel, a specialist in traumatic stress, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And that wraps up another edition of MedClinic Radio, a production of Syndication Networks. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll be here again next week for more MedClinic Radio.